CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good morning. Good evening. In the news this week, we'll be bringing you a live interview with Cynthia Koo, a writer with the UBC, talking about a recent article in which she examined the possible impacts of the Olympics on the UBC campus. We'll also be bringing you an interview with AMS President Blake Fredrickson, talking about why the UBC student body has chosen to leave the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations. Finally, Andrew Longhurst heard Five-Ring Circus author Chris Shaw speak as part of the Olympic Myths series at Green College. He was speaking on the idea of privatized profit and socialized debt. We'll have all this, plus arts, and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. This evening, we have the pleasure of having Cynthia Koo, a writer from the UBC, in studio with us to talk about a recent article in which she examined the impact of the 2010 Olympics on UBC.
Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for joining us in studio today.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Cynthia, this week in the UBC wrote an article entitled Vanock, UBC Contract Censored. Blacked out portions of the agreement raise questions. And this was printed in the October 19th issue of the UBC. So can you tell us a little bit about what the Vanock UBC venue use agreement is?
Well, basically, when Vanock and UBC decided to have UBC help deliver part of the games, they entered into an agreement where Vanock would actually help UBC build an arena, which is now known as the Doug Mitchell Thunderbird Winter Sports Center. And as part of this agreement, Vanock decided to put forth, I believe it was $38 or $39.5 million, and UBC would put up the remaining $10 million. So they drew up a contract to set out the terms of the construction of the arena, such as financing costs, so forth. And the AMS requested to see this contract. They had to file a Freedom of Information request to do so. And upon receiving it, several sections of it were redacted or blacked out. And so that's when the UBC started to look into it.
Why do you believe that a number of these sections were blacked out?
Well, actually, we found out upon talking to people from UBC and a spokesperson from Vanock is that every single section that was blacked out, it was actually said right on the contract itself, the copy that was delivered to the AMS, that it was under Section 21 of the Freedom of Information and Privacy Protection Act. And basically that says that if the information, if reviewed, would harm the business interests of a third party, which in this case is Vanock, then UBC actually is mandated under law to withhold that information.
Okay. And can you make the distinction, because Vanock and UBC are not subject to the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act? They're subject to a different
Well,
act?
The distinction is that UBC actually is subject to the Freedom of Information and Privacy Protection Act. That's the one that applies to public bodies. And Vanock, however, is a private body, and so it's subject to another act called the Protection of Information and Privacy Act, I believe. And so the main difference between the two is that under FIPPA, the one that applies to public bodies, they have to reveal information to an applicant about themselves or about the applicant if the applicant's requesting information, or about themselves, the organization. Whereas the private body must reveal information about the applicant. For instance, banks have to give you your own information, but they don't necessarily have to release information about themselves. So the interesting thing here is that UBC normally would have to reveal information such as financial statements, things like that, because they're a public body. But because they're tied to Vanock through this contract, Vanock being a private body, is that UBC ends up having to not release that information.
And so, in terms of accountability, do you think the university is trying to avoid being accountable, especially to students who the AMS had to file a Freedom of Information request to receive, to even get this report? Do you think accountability is a major issue and something that the university is trying to avoid?
That's hard to say in this particular issue, I think, because one of the things that we did find out, I think, to be fair to them, is that everything was under Section 21, which isn't something under PIPA. It is under FIPA. And so what I found out is that they're actually mandated by law to conceal this information. And when I spoke to Stephen Owen, he said outright that everything redacted in this contract was VANOC. Nothing was UBC. So in terms of the larger picture, whether UBC could be doing a better job delivering information to students, probably yes. But in this particular case, I think just to be fair to them, we do have to recognize that there was that legislation.
Did you have any luck reaching a spokesperson from VANOC on the issue?
I did have a bit of luck. I emailed their media relations department, and I received a statement that I think was written by an unnamed staffer and then confirmed by their spokesperson, where they basically said they gave us a list of efforts that they'd made to show that they were dedicated to transparency, such as the website, newsletters, press releases, and so forth. And I think they basically just said that they were doing the best they could within the constraints of the budget and the time limit they had to deliver these games safely and responsibly.
Okay. And so, you know, moving forward, where does the AMS stand in the relationship that they have with VANOC?
I believe there was a separate article on this actually related to mine in the UBC. It just came out today. And I believe their stance was they decided to be neutral about the Olympics and not actually be proactive for or against them.
Okay. Well, and so are there any other... is there any other information that listeners should be left with that you found in this report?
No, I think that's about it. Thank you
okay.
very much.
Well, thanks for joining us in studio. Cynthia Koo from the UBC is joining us in studio. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's now time for some public service announcements, but stay tuned for more local and campus news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story to touch lives.
Hip-hop artist Emmanuel Jal, once a child soldier in Sudan, has returned to his home country, and this time his weapon is a microphone. His unique story and effort to build peace, War Child, is just one of the 25 films featured this year at the Amnesty International Film Festival, November 12th to 15th at the Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Full program available at amnestyfilmfest.ca. Brought to you in part by CITR Radio.
Me, I got a reason for being on this earth, cause I know more than many was a life is worth better. Now that I get a chance to stand my ground, I'm gonna run over mountains, leaps and bounds.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his lab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was what are you doing on Halloween? How about making a difference? Join us for Trick or Eat, an event where students go door-to-door in university neighborhoods to collect food and raise awareness of hunger in Vancouver. Last year, Trick or Eat raised over 6,600 pounds of food. Join the over 400 students dressed up in true Halloween style on Saturday, October 31st, 2009, from 4 to 7:30 p.m. to make a big difference. Whatever your plans, make Trick or Eat a part of your evening. A few hours of your time can make a huge difference in the lives of Vancouver's hungry and poor. This year, we are specifically looking for people to drive their cars to help transport food from nearby communities back to campus for Trick or Eat. If you have a car and would be willing to donate your time, please email ubc at mealexchange.com.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101. Right now, it's 5:09 and time to take a look at the world of Canadian student politics. On campus this week, the hot topic has been whether UBC will remain a member of CASA, the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations. The AMS has been trying to distance itself from the alliance for some time, but this week a vote was taken on whether the UBC would leave the group entirely. For insight into the controversy, Megan Turcato spoke with AMS President Blake Fredrickson.
So first of all, just because I know a lot of students aren't really familiar with it, can you explain what the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations is and what its purpose is?
Yes. So the Canadian Alliance of Student Association is a federal lobbying organization, and a number of student associations across Canada pay in to this lobbying organization, and what they get in return is this group called CASA lobbying the federal government on student issues.
So what prompted the AMS's decision to leave CASA?
There's actually been a number of historical ongoing concerns that the AMS has had with CASA. Specifically, when the council voted to leave CASA this week, there were three primary cited concerns. The first was that despite the fact that our students make up about 20% of the entire organization of CASA, we don't have enough say or influence over over CASA. The second was that the AMS is simply a poor fit for CASA. So the AMS is actually the largest student association in Canada, and as a result, we have the benefit of having a lot of our own lobbying resources, and we don't need a lot of the lobbying resources that CASA provides.
Were there specific issues where the AMS and CASA disagreed?
There have been in the past, so CASA and AMS's lobbying priorities haven't always fit, but more pertinent is the fact that CASA focuses only on federal lobbying issues. The AMS has made it very clear that we want to focus as an organization much more heavily on provincial lobbying because we feel very strongly that the provincial government is the branch of government that is most responsible for post-secondary education issues and the issues that students care about.
Do you feel that leaving CASA could further fragment the student voice and lead to, I guess, lobbying in different directions or opposite directions from each other?
That could be a point that one would raise, but the issue that the AMS Council raised was that although we were a part of CASA, we didn't actually have much say or influence over the direction of CASA. And as a result, even though we were members of CASA, we, at the same time, already focused on much of our efforts on lobbying were done independently already.
Would the AMS consider joining the alternative student lobbying group, the Canadian Federations of Students?
Well, one thing that the AMS has made explicitly clear is that we intend to remain as independent and unaffiliated from any federal lobbying organization for a period of at least 1 year. Our mandate will continue to be to lobby federally as well as provincially and locally, but we will do that independently.
Recently, Kuwaitland decided to become a member of both lobbying organizations. Why has UBC decided that they want to be independent and work alone instead of being in a group with the other universities?
It is based on the historical relationship that the AMS has had with CASA, and it is the reasons that I cited before that we're just not a good fit with the organization. We don't have influence, and we want to focus our efforts on provincial lobbying, and being a part of CASA doesn't give us that opportunity.
Thank you for talking with me today.
Yeah, have a nice day.
Thanks, Megan, for that piece. In local news, we now turn to reporter Janelle Chung, who spoke with Emily and Jonathan at the UBC United Way on their fundraising efforts for children and seniors in the Lower Mainland.
We're here with the UBC United Way campaign coordinator, Emily, and the student chair, Jonathan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So can you tell me more about what you do and who you help?
All right. So United Way is a great organization. The one that the UBC campaign supports is United Way of the Lower Mainland. And they support various organizations. So they do a lot of work with children from 0 to 6, children from 6 to 12, and seniors. And the money all stays in the Lower Mainland.
Yeah. And as Emily touched upon, that the children from 0 to 6, we're trying to enable them to get the best possible start in life. And children 6 to 12 prevent gang prevention, like mentor them, provide them with after-school care, and for senior citizens, help them lead independent and prosperous lives.
So you're a little different from other charities where your proceeds are spread among various agencies around the Lower Mainland. How are your proceeds divided?
Well, United Way kind of determines that. So what we do is we raise a bunch of money with the UBC campaign, We're the biggest in the Lower Mainland, by the way. And so that goes to United Way of the Lower Mainland, and they do a bunch of research on sort of what will be needed about 5 to 10 years from now and what people will be most at risk. So through that, they donate to different organizations that they think will help our future problems can arise.
So on your website, you have a quote by Maxine Green. It says, "The opposite of morality, it has often been said, is indifference, a lack of care, an absence of concern." Do you think that UBC students are unaware, or they're just not taking enough action?
I think that they're more so just unaware. Most people I've talked to have yet to hear about the United Way campaign at UBC, let alone what the United Way does.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been focused on staff and faculty. And I think that students have so much to offer, but being a student myself, I find that school does take the front seat, and we can be very active in different organizations, but we really need to kind of be pushed to do it, I think.
Right. Yeah. So this year, there's a couple of things you're doing differently. One of them is that you're going green.
Yes, we are. Greenish, as we call it. So all the donations that used to go out by paper pledge, they are now online. Mm-hmm. So I think we're, I forget the figures now, but it's, last year it was like 500,000 pieces of paper, something like that. And now it's, you know, down to the 1,000 level.
Okay.
So big changes there.
How does the economy affect the donations you've been receiving?
Well, right now we still have a strong donation support. Mm-hmm. Like we've had lots of people donate at the leadership level, which is $1,000 plus for a month of staff and faculty. And that's still showing strong support, despite the economic downturn.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But the people who receive funding, that's sort of where the economic downturn will affect.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who are poor are now very poor. And the people who are homeless are now, you know, completely destitute. So really in the receiving end, that's kind of where the changes are being made, I think.
As we're talking about increased student awareness, your goal this year is not to is not necessarily a monetary amount. It's to double the student participation at UBC.
Yeah, well, not just double. It's just have students involved.
Yeah, more students.
Yeah, last year there was no one knew about it. I didn't know about it last year, but now I'm getting my friends. We have lots of posters. We have Facebook groups. Mm-hmm. We have welcome messages on the United Way website. We have broadcast emails sent to students.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are more aware of it now.
Right.
And we have a strong volunteer base that we can call upon now.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So many people are getting involved, and, you know, we want to thank them for that. A lot of students are really interested, so we're excited about it.
Mm-hmm. So you're taking advantage of a lot of the different faculties at UBC. Usually if there's a charity or a fundraiser going on, they focus only on one faculty or one program, but you've really kind of used everything.
Yeah, well, like, it's a campus-wide community campaign. That's why the new campaign name is Community, because we're trying to involve everyone in it. So we have support from science, arts, engineering, forestry, land and food, and whatnot.
In the next few weeks, you have a lot of events coming up.
Lots of events.
Can you talk more about them?
Yeah. I don't know. Jonathan, do you want to start with the Great Pancake Race?
Yes.
That's going to be exciting.
Yes. First off, on Thursday, which is October 29th, at 12 o'clock to 1:30, there's going to be the Great Pancake Race, in which students, faculty, and staff will be competing against each other, doing a relay race in which they hold a pancake or frying pan with a pancake in it, and they run back and forward and flip the pancake 3 times. So everyone's going to dress up, there's ridiculous team names, and a lot of the deans and high faculty members that are noticeable will be there, so you can see your favorite dean dress up and act silly, essentially.
Make a fool of him or herself.
Okay.
It's at Thursday, October 29th, and it's Kerner Plaza, so right in front of the Kerner Library, which is, it's going to be good. Lots of visibility, lots of fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun, and it's the first one happening at UBC, right?
First pancake race in general.
I don't even know if the Lower Mainland has done them. It's a big thing in Britain,
right?
And a lot of the parliamentarians, they race and they make fools of themselves, but I guess we just haven't caught on to this one thing.
Yeah, and this event's free to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Just come out, have a good time.
So if students are interested in volunteering, in participating, or in fundraising, how can they reach you?
Well, the best way is to join the Facebook group, the UBC Community United Way Campaign 2009, and that will enable you to get messages from me about student volunteer opportunities. So I'll be sending out like a message to all the group members, and I'll say, here's volunteer opportunities. So for the pancake race, we will need volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And then people will respond and say, I can help this time. And I'll say, yes, no, maybe so.
Right. And Facebook is just such an easy way.
Right.
You know, it's so easy to go on and just get your notifications, and you don't even really have to participate that much, mm-hmm. but just join and see what's going on. There's also a garage sale at Gage.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the 28th at 11:30 a.m., and I heard last year a student got an iPod Touch for $20 or something like that. So come out. It's the Gage Commons block at 11:30. Good prizes and things like that to be won. Mm-hmm. Also, should we touch on PJ?
Yeah, we should. So our last big event for the United Way campaign this year is going to be Pajama Day.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept is you buy a button, so it's similar to the concept of Jeans Day at the workplace, but at EBC everyone wears jeans, so instead we're going to wear pajamas.
Right.
So what you do is you buy a button to support United Way.
It's a cute little purple button. Mm-hmm. The girls will love it.
Guys,
says,
too.
I love PJs. Well, guys, too. Yes, mm-hmm. I can't say that. Anyways, sorry, Jonathan.
Yeah, so then you just wear your pajamas to school, and ideally you want to get as many people involved. So there will be, like, staff, faculty, deans. It's always fun to see your dean in pajamas.
Right. Definitely.
It's rare.
Yeah. And you can get your buttons from food services, from enrollment services at Brock Hall. Mm-hmm. And also from library circulation desks. So I know you guys are all out there studying, and pick up a button while you're there.
And there will be some students floating around soliciting buttons to you.
It's by donation, so it's a really good thing for students as well.
Right.
Yeah.
We have tight finances, you know that.
Thanks for coming in and talking to us today.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Janelle for bringing us that story. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Next, we bring you coverage of a recent lecture by Five Ring Circus author Chris Shaw.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless. It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power science world for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Far too often, corporations operate in ways that destroy the environment and violate human rights. From northern Alberta to the Ecuadorian Amazon, oil companies have extracted great wealth and left behind only destruction and poverty. To learn more, plan now to attend the Amnesty International Film Festival, November 12th to 15th at the Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Full program available at amnestyfilmfest.ca. Brought to you in part by CITR Radio.
Hi, this is Mick from Bell and Sebastian, and you're listening to DITR 101.9 FM.
This boy and girl coming home from school look quite content with life. And why not? They're looking forward to an important date, dinner at home with the family. What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
Luckily, UBC students have lots of on-campus dining options.
Bernoulli's Bagels, serving up authentic Montreal-style bagels made fresh daily on the premises, in addition to sandwiches, soups, squealers, calzones, and freshly squeezed juice. Bernoulli's is located on the main concourse of the sub and open Monday through Saturday. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society. Hey, as far as I'm so bad, my
time's a bird. Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. A few weeks ago, Chris Shaw, author of Five Ring Circus, spoke on campus and discussed the notion of privatized profit and socialized debt.
On Monday, October 5th, Professor Christopher Shaw spoke at Green College at UBC as part of the ongoing Olympic Critics Speaker Series. He is a professor at UBC and is the author of Five Ring Circus, Myths and Realities of the Olympic Games. His lecture, entitled The Hidden Fourth Pillar of the Olympic Games, Privatized Profit, Socialized Debt, touched on a variety of issues related to the Olympic Games. He primarily spoke about the supposed public benefits of hosting the Games. Professor Shaw first speaks about those most involved in pushing for the Olympic bid.
This gentleman, his name is Jack Poole. He is the CEO of VANOC. Before that, he was the CEO of the Bid Corps, which is the organization that brought us the Games. And in a candid moment, he has a few, in a candid moment, he got up in front of a bunch of developers, I think it was in Squamish in 2002, and also, unfortunately, some reporters were there, and he said if the Games weren't coming, we'd have to invent something. And what he meant by that, we think, was that they needed some sort of means to get you and me to invest in their private deals. Because all the things that this gentleman had done over the years, and this, by the way, this is his partner in crime, a fellow named David Podmore, who's now the CEO of Concert Properties. Concert Properties, before it was Concert Properties, was something called Greystone, which was trying to get the convention center downtown and was trying to do different deals. And before that, it was something called Vancouver Land Corporation, which managed to get the city of Vancouver to sell them for $10 a 99-year lease on almost 100 acres of property along waterfront land. One councillor at the time, Jonathan Baker, called it the greatest land deal since the Dutch bought Manhattan from the Indians for $24 of junk jewelry. Concert Properties, Concert Properties is the new incarnation. Jack managed, in the course of various previous companies he had run, he had lost his investors $3 billion, which you'd think would not be an enormously enticing thing for other people to want to invest in, certainly not to make this guy the head of a multi-billion dollar project. And yet back in the early, early 80s, this gentleman was approached by none other than Gordon Campbell. Gordon Campbell was then the mayor of Vancouver, and Gordon Campbell, I think most of you are familiar with his politics and his policies, Gordon Campbell decided that he urgently needed social housing in Vancouver. That was just a priority for him as mayor. And he turned to Jack Poole, who was retiring, and he was retiring because his investors had kicked him out of the companies he'd destroyed, and he said, Jack, I want you to start a new corporation. We're going to call it Vancouver Land Corporation. We're going to fund it with city money, provincial money, and union pension funds, and you're going to run it, and you're going to build social housing. Well, guess what they didn't build? Okay, but anyway, that was the beginning of Vancouver Land Corporation. So what did Concert Properties and its previous incarnations want when they were Greystone? They wanted a new convention center. They tried to push that deal through from way back, and this was through the 90s. Ultimately, the NDP government rejected it because the cost was going to be over the top, insane. And guess what actually happened? They got their convention center, and the cost was over the top, insane. What was supposed to be almost a $480 million project became almost a $900 million project. Okay. They wanted ski resort development in the Callahan Valley. Guess what they're going to get? They wanted developments along the See the Sky Highway and along the corridor to Whistler. If you've driven that corridor lately, you know that's exactly what's happening up and down the corridor. And, of course, they wanted ultimately to control the Athletes' Village, and we know that because these guys actually made a bid on it, even though Mr. Poole had said back before the Games were awarded that Concert Properties had no financial interest in anything associated with the Olympics and wouldn't bid on anything. And 2 years later, he put a bid on the village. Other developers, what did they want? They wanted to gentrify the downtown east side. They wanted the same thing, the See the Sky corridor enhanced. They wanted to develop, there were many ski resort attempts to try and piggyback on the backs of the Olympics, whether they were in Melbourne Creek, also called Shutika, where there's been a blockade since 2000, at Chiam, down in the valley, and at Brome Ridge near Squamish. And, of course, they wanted an airport connector, a new subway line from the airport into downtown Vancouver. And these items, the new convention center, the See the Sky Highway upgrade, and the RAB, or Canada Line Connector, were all essential to getting the bid. They were considered to be absolute must-haves if we're going to get the bid. So what does the IOC get? Well, the IOC basically gets a lot of money is what they get. They don't pay income taxes on this planet. Anyway, they don't pay income taxes in Canada, the host country. The federal government snuck a clause into the 2007 federal budget that made them tax exempt as a non-profit organization. They don't pay taxes in Vancouver. They don't pay taxes in the province of British Columbia. And they sure as heck do not pay taxes in Switzerland, because Switzerland also curiously considers them a non-profit organization. they have an enormous amount of privilege. Andrew Jennings, who will be speaking later in the series, will tell you about it. And they live like the new kings of the universe. So in it, what's in it for them? A lot of money and a lot of prestige and power.
Professor Shaw then goes on to debunk the myth that the games are a moneymaker for both the province and the host city.
Basically, there is very little money to be made in the Olympics if you count all the costs. If you do purely economic impacts and you don't look at all the costs, you don't look at the infrastructure you have to build, you don't look at the super projects that you have to do because the IOC wants them, and you don't look at the security costs, and we'll come back to security costs, you're not going to make any money. And there is a new study that just came out, just released, as far as I know, on last Thursday from Western University that is going to make that point even more clearly. So again, those are your numbers. That's what you could possibly get. And then they estimated tourism from various estimates. So again, there's your kind of medium high. You could get 2.7 million tourists coming to the province of BC during this time. But the caveats, again, are these. Okay, so sure, even if you want to double it and say the out-of-province impact could be as big as the the out-of-province thing is going to be the one numbers we just saw. The in-province thing could be at least as big. So double the numbers you've just heard. But it didn't measure the positive impacts against the costs required to obtain them, as a cost-benefit analysis would do. Okay. And again, cost-benefit analysis, a true cost-benefit analysis, would not only look at the economic numbers, it would consider the impact on the environment, it would consider the impact on the poor, it would consider the impact on things such as what we call opportunity costs. What happens if you don't build the community? What if you use that money for something else? So, this is the latest report that was just released, an article called Olympic Caveats, Host Cities Risk Debt and Scandal by Howard Burks, released on October 1st. Basically said, if money-making were an Olympic event, no city hosting the Games would win a gold medal, or silver, or bronze. That's a pretty safe, pretty clear statement. And is based on a study by Robert Barney of the Center for Olympic Studies at Western University, who blatantly says there's never been an Olympic Games that has made a profit. And I think Mr. Barney is correct. And that flies in the face of most of the stuff we've been told. We've been told that Los Angeles made a profit. It did, but only if you look at the operating period. We've been told that Calgary made a profit. It made a marginal profit. We've been told that Barcelona got a new port, which it did, but for a huge capital outlay. So these things are highlighted as, this is your Nigerian banking scam. You can make this profit if you only open up your bank account. If you gamble with your money, you can actually make a lot of money. But again, the numbers, if you go back in history and look at across the board, you are very unlikely to do so. In fact, you're likely to lose a lot of money. So let's do a reality check. The promises in 2002, and there were a lot of promises made by Bidcorp and later by Vanoc. We were told that the overall cost to taxpayers, provincial and federal, were going to be something around about $660 million. That was going to be all in, everything. Okay. We were told, Larry Campbell said this, the games won't cost Vancouver one penny. Well, as we'll see, Larry may actually have been telling the truth because it's a little bit more than a penny, but let's say he meant it as not costing anything. As Richard Daley in Chicago just recently told his citizens before his bid got kicked out of the park, that it wouldn't cost Chicagoans a dime. Vanoc's business plans had the fundamental assumption, and it was stated in the business plan, which was released, by the way, 3 years late, that the economy will continue to be strong through 2010. Which was a kind of an amazing statement to be making at the time, considering that people such as Alan Greenspan had been talking about this irrational exuberance and the problem of the markets, and the problem, furthermore, that the subprime industry was likely to take down the entire real estate industry in North America, as it did. And it's not as if this stuff wasn't known. It's not as if people didn't realize that the economy had real issues, that you could go into a recession. But Vanoc, in building his business plan, and this is unusual for a business plan, and I've built business plans before. Vanoc, for its business plan, didn't have any range of outcomes. They didn't say, okay, here's how great it could be, here's how bad it could be, and here's the middle course. They had, no, just the happy, happy, joy, joy. Everything's going to be perfect through 2010, leaving aside all this other stuff, and that things, that all it can possibly do, the rose-colored glasses firmly planted on their faces, that's one option. The other one is that they're lying. And that all of these things can only generate money, and the economy can only improve. These were things that were essential. The Convention Center Airport Connector and the Sea to Sky Highway had to be happening for the Games. The IOC told Vanoc and the government in no uncertain terms, well, it was Bidcorp at the time, no uncertain terms, that they needed to be able to get to Whistler faster. Therefore, improve the highway. And as always, organizers bow and immediately go obey the IOC. They were told, for example, that the mega construction projects would boost the economy, but it comes back to our first question, is that the way to build an economy? That it would help the poor and the homeless, and this is a bit of the Milton Friedman-esque oats through the horse feeding the sparrows idea, and that security costs were trivial, nothing, practically free, $175 million. And that they would make sure that native symbols and culture were an integral part of the games. So what, 7 years later, what do we see? Well, the cost that we know about, and I want to emphasize know about, because we don't know all of the amounts of money spent. What we know about is about $6 billion.
To listen to Professor Shaw's lecture in its entirety, please visit our website at citr.ca. The Olympic Critic Speaker Series at Green College continues till Monday, December 7th. Lectures begin at 5 o'clock and are about an hour long. For more information, please visit our website at www.citr.ca.
Thanks to Andrew for that coverage. It's time for another break. Up next is arts and your weekend weather forecast. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Green College presents a series of lectures by Olympic critics, organizers, and academics highlighting many of the negative impacts of the Olympic Games. Vancouver will soon host the 2010 Winter Olympic Games, promoted by the organizers and government as a major benefit for Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada. Yet, negative impacts of the Games are already being felt. Cost overruns have become routine. The athletes' village risks making the city of Vancouver insolvent. There has been environmental damage. Unceded Indigenous land and resources are being exploited. And homelessness has increased by over 400% since 2003. Lectures are taking place most Mondays from September 14th to December 7th at 5 p.m. at the Green College Coach House. The lectures are free and open to the public. For more information on individual speakers, visit www.greencollege.ubc.ca.
First learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website www.spec.bc.ca for more information.
February 15th, 2003.
On this day in 2003, record-breaking protests flooded the streets of over 800 cities across the planet. George Bush called this global demonstration a mere focus group, while Patrick Tyler of the New York Times said the protests show there are now two superpowers on the planet, the United States and worldwide public opinion. 1 month later, the U.S. invaded Iraq, and the peace movement had evidently failed. Since then, many now argue to achieve a world without war, we must rethink the paradigm of peace.
Vancouver's Community Television Association presents a special benefit screening of Think Peace, Portrait of a 21st Century Movement. The film takes audiences back to the historic Vancouver Peace Forum of 2006. To pose the question, what is peace, and how do we achieve it? Think Peace, Portrait of a 21st Century Movement will screen Tuesday, October 27th at 7 p.m. in the Norm Theater.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire. Mind,
you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah. Situation.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:39 and time for the arts. And for that, we go to Tracy Fuller.
Hey there, happy Friday. My name is Tracy Fuller, and this is your weekend arts update for Friday, October 23rd, 2009. There are lots of exciting events going on around town this weekend, so get out from under the rain and get into some of the great venues offering great art and entertainment around town. First off, tonight at the Vancouver Art Gallery, Fuse is on, and it's a Halloween theme, Good Fuse, Evil Fuse, and that's featuring a bunch of local artists and all of the wonderful art that is already on exhibit at the Art Gallery, so head on down to check that out. In classical music, the UBC School of Music's University Singers are presenting What Dreams May Come at the Chan Center this weekend, and that's tonight at 8 p.m., and that's a free concert. The Vancouver Symphony Orchestra is hosting violinist Rachel Barton Pine playing Respighi, Saint-Saëns, and other pieces. That's Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Orpheum. In theater, Hurley Burley, David Rabe's exploration of mid-level Hollywood players of the 1980s is opening up at the Jericho Arts Center. That runs tonight and through this weekend and next weekend at 8 p.m. Memory, Jonathan Lichtenstein's play within a play about actors negotiating the story of a Holocaust survivor after the fall of the Berlin Wall and a Palestinian who refuses to abandon his home to Israeli authorities is on at the Havana Theater. That's this weekend at 8 p.m. and tickets are available at the door. Evil Dead, the musical, just opened up at the Vogue Theater downtown. The station manager at CITR, Brenda Gruno, and myself went out to check it out last night, and be sure to wear your poncho. There's lots of blood spattering enjoyment, great music, great adventure, action, and entertainment going on at the Vogue. So if you're into Evil Dead, if you're looking for something to do on Halloween, I would definitely say that's probably your premier choice here in Vancouver this year. Also on about town, the Vancouver Theater Sports League continues to have Bacheloretta, their new show. It plays Thursday through Saturday at the new review stage on Granville Island. Provincial Essays is a five-dance presentation of Lola McLaughlin's choreography Landscapes, which explores modern society's relationship with the natural world. That's on at the Culch until October 24th. Tickets are available at the door at 8 p.m. The Reckoning of Violet Jessop continues at the Maritime Museum. This is a one-woman play by writer-performer Jenny Abel, and tickets are available at the door. The show starts at 8 p.m. In music, the Jesus Lizard is playing this Saturday at the Commodore Ballroom, and on Sunday, Shonen Knife and the Strange Magic will be at the Biltmore Cabaret. Hope in the Shadows, the 7th annual photography competition wherein downtown Eastside residents capture real-life moments, is closing this weekend at the Pendulum Gallery. That's 885 West Georgia, and that's until Saturday. Virtual Vancouver Artist Showcase and Party featuring real world and real visual art, live entertainment, and live painting sessions is on at the Roundhouse Theater tonight. That's from 7 to 11 p.m., and admission is free. The Exchange Show is closing at Emily Carr, that's 1399 Johnson, and this is the third year Emily Carr students who completed international student exchanges and the work that they produced abroad. Visions of the Promised Landscape, photos by Lauren Greenberg, is on from October 22nd to December 6th at the Sydney and Gertrude Zach Gallery. Beijing, Vancouver, paintings by Nova Scotia-based artists Gary Neil Kennedy and Kathy Busby is on at Center A, that's 2 West Hastings. The Vancouver Writers and Readers Festival continues and is ending this Sunday, and writers include Douglas Copeland, Alistair MacLeod, Kathy Reichs, and more. For more information, you should visit writersfestbc.ca. The Vancouver Short Film Festival, the first annual short film festival, features speakers panels, student film screenings, and select screenings of the best short films from around the world. This is on until tomorrow, that's Saturday, October 24th, at the Van City Theatre, 1181 Seymour, and information's at vsff.com. The Celluloid Social Club is on tonight. Admission, as always, is $5. And this monthly short film screening followed by Q&A is Halloween-themed, this year focusing on the 48-hour horror filmmaking challenge. Head on down to the Anza Club to check it out. And that's your weekend arts update. For all arts news, tune in to The Arts Report every Wednesday on CITR from 5 to 6 p.m. And if you want to reach me here at The Arts, you can always email me at arts@citr.ca. And until next week, stay dry, stay warm, and have a great weekend.
And that's our program for October 23rd, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or be part of the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Tricotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 for another edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. For the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for sports. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.